follow the admonition of the Babylonian deity Nebo. What has been, will be. Therefore, we say, 500 years ago, people did a certain thing and this happened to them. Therefore, if today we observe people doing the same thing, we assume that in the interval of the future, the same thing will happen to them. Thus, by means of these two intervals, we orient the present. And we use the past as an instruction. And we face the future as an opportunity. We also recognize that the interval of the future is always partly bridged from both the present and the past. But that these bridges are susceptible of modification. And as Pythagoras expressed it, nearly every individual who is working for the future is trying to modify the inevitable. He is trying to make some changes, lesser or greater, in patterns which otherwise will remain unchangeable. That is the basis of politics, the basis of education, the basis of reform, is that if the future extends in terms of the present, it will be inadequate. Therefore, the problem of the contribution of the individual or of the collective to the modification of the inevitables of the future. These efforts constitute change or motion. Qualitative motion. Now, quantitative motion and qualitative motion are two different things. A thing which goes a mile on the ground achieves a certain quantitative motion. An individual who, being not intelligent, becomes more intelligent, achieves qualitative motion. For qualitative motion is in terms of improvement of quality. Quantitative motion is in terms of spanning of distances upon a level. It is therefore said that qualitative motion moves on an oblique line mathematically, and quantitative motion on a horizontal line. Pythagoras added that illumination or spiritual motion moves on a vertical line. Therefore, we have the spiritual life of man represented by a vertical, his intellectual psychic life by an oblique, and his physical life by a horizontal. And in one of the old mystery systems of the ancients, it was customary to initiate the candidate by raising him from the horizontal to the oblique and from the oblique to the perpendicular. This symbolism is significant to some people. In the same concept, qualitative motion, because it is an ascending motion, on an oblique, becomes the motion of the human soul, or the human mind. We will find some more about that in the Hypotenuse of the 47th proposition of Euclid, which we will take up in another discussion. But we have in that Hypotenuse the three lines, the horizontal, the vertical, and the oblique. And in this, we have the story of the life of man, the entire psychic field of human growth and progress. If, therefore, qualitative motion is upon an oblique, thereby all growth is an ascending arc or ascending line. This means that the circle of material activity is changed into a cycle of psychic activity, because a cycle is a spiral and a circle is upon a circuit. Therefore, a spiral is an ascending circle. And Pythagoras taught that the soul of man is so constituted that it can never, under any condition, repeat itself in anything. If it appears to repeat itself, it repeats itself with a certain qualitative interval by which the circle has been changed into a cycle. The reason for this is that no individual, even though he walks the same road every morning, can be identically the same person in two different days. The individual, Monday morning, very carefully, follows a certain path, and comes back and goes over it again Tuesday morning. The path is the same. He has followed it the same, but something has happened to him in the meantime. He is not the same person in every particular. During the interval, he read the newspaper. That was enough to change him, probably for the worse. And during this period of time, he has perhaps made a new friend. He has read a new book. He has heard a new report. He has studied something. He has improved himself in some particular. He has made a new friend, a lost an old one. Perhaps he's made an enemy. But he's going to learn even from that. He is not identically the same person. Because in the 24 hours difference, some changes, some thoughts, some experience, even though trivial, must have occurred to him, by which the numerative soul compound of himself is different. And because the individual, always different, can do the same thing, but is himself never the same, Pythagoras used a spiral to represent a return to a similar point, but not an identical one. Because in the return, the oblique line of growth has resulted in a gradual ascent, even though it may be an extremely slight ascent. This is the basis of the entire cyclic concept of evolution as we have it in the modern world. So here we have the problem of interval, and we have these dots in this tetraxis surrounded by intervals. Intervals also are what the Pythagorean soul calls tonal interludes. Every single interval in nature has a tonal equivalent. Pythagoras pointed out that the difference in tones are not due to the essential substances involved, but in the case of a musical instrument, the location and placing of the fret. In other words, the intervals on the same string create different tones. Therefore, you may have the diapente or the diatessaron according to the placing of the frets upon a string. And the length of the interval between the frets determines the tone, and not the fret itself nor the string. Therefore, in the Pythagorean system of astronomy, the music of the spheres was not based upon the concept that the planets had tones, but that the intervals between the planets were tonal. Therefore, Pythagoras divided the heaven from the earth to the empyrean into a single corded instrument, which he called the celestial monochord. He placed the fret in the locations of the planets, and then declared that the intervals between these constituted the basis of the sidereal harmony. The Greeks, accepting this process and concept, created their idea of modal music, the mode being arrived at by the rearrangement according to mathematical formula of the frets relating to the various strings, in the same way as we tune an instrument today. Thus, we come back to a very important point in connection with the tetraxis, namely that all these rows of numbers consist of numbers and intervals. Now, for example, on the lower line, we have four dots. These four dots, therefore, enclose a certain number of intervals. And how many intervals do we have between four dots? Quick, somebody. Three. I just want to make sure everyone's awake. All right. Three intervals and four dots. Now, this in itself gives us a very significant number, the number seven. Therefore, we have four things and three spaces constituting a septet. Now, if we, for instance, want to go into the old symbolism of Freemasonry, we remember the Master Mason's apron, which consists of a square into which falls a triangle. Here is a septenary. Now, in this septenary also, we can go back to our ancient Hindus and Babylonians, who placing a pyramid upon a cube declared this to represent the entire structure of the world. Three constitutes the divine number, or divine number of equilibrium. Four constitutes the number of forms. Therefore, within the four dots of form are three intervals, or spiritual interludes. And these constitute what the Pythagoreans call consciousness, intelligence, and thought. They are all intervals, or interludes. They are energies invisible. They are the field in which the four dots operate. Therefore, the four elements are held together by three spiritual powers, which are termed binders, or are termed the materials or substances necessary to the manifestation of these dots. Now comes a very nice question. We don't have to go out and follow Euclid to commit suicide over this, but we do have a delicate issue. What happens to the interval if you take away the dots? That's what an English cricket player would call a sticky wicket. Now, what do we do about this? If we take away the dots, well, the intervals are lost. And we can't take away the intervals. If we take away the intervals, the dots merge together. Because they are held apart or just separately because of interval only. So if we remove one of those dots, we remove with it one of the intervals. Therefore, we come to another very interesting thing. A problem that has been asked many times on another level. If an explosion occurred where there was no one here, would there be any noise? That's one of the very old questions. And that's been subject to a lot of analysis. The question then, of course, remains as to the meaning of the thought or concept of noise. If by noise we mean only that which is the result of certain vibrations of the eardrum, there could be no noise if there was no eardrum. But there would still be a vibratory circumstance of some nature, whether anybody heard it or not. But it would not be sound unless there was an ear to hear it. Now, we have the same problem in connection with dots and intervals. Energy could not manifest unless there were forms through which they could express themselves. Therefore, the moment you take away a number, you remove all of the manifestation of the intervals contained within that number. You also will discover, as you proceed, that the intervals are always one less than the number. And therefore, that in all these various problems, you always have an interesting situation. If your intervals are even, your numbers will be odd. And so on, down through the entire problem. And as you have in your odd numbers, your positive numbers, and in your even numbers, your negative numbers, there are certain compounds in which intervals are positive, and other compounds in which the objects or the numbers are positive. This, again, opens a very large field of Pythagorean speculation. But we are dealing primarily with the recognition that all patterns of number release into objectivity measurable intervals, which cannot be measured until numbers are established. The moment you establish two dots in two places, you can measure the interval between them. Take away one of the dots, the interval remains but becomes immeasurable. It becomes one with eternal interval, the moment your boundary is removed. Therefore, you can measure an interval between things, but not an interval between one thing. Because the interval between one thing and totality is always the same. It is essentially immeasurable. Therefore, where two or more things come into manifestation, separate interval comes into existence, and Pythagoras called interval individuality. And this again becomes quite a stimulating thought, because individuality for its existence requires the number two, because it must have boundary and interval. And within an interval between the two dots of the tetrahedron, individuality can exist, because the relation of the two dots to each other can be changed. And because of that, individuality can be infinite and still measurable, in the sense of infinite number of possible association of the two dots. But that association is arithmetical, because it is on a level or on a line or on a plane. No matter where you place the two dots, a line between them is a hypothetical horizontal. Therefore, there can be no dimension beyond the dimension of the line in the connection of any two dots. Consequently, the entire concept of this interval is interval on a surface, because actually the two dots can be the end of a line. And hypothetically, a line connected them has these dots for an end. Thus, however, if we have duality, this duality as two dots captures and holds an interval, and this interval becomes individuality and measurable. Removing one of these dots restores unity, and the moment unity is restored, individuality becomes immeasurable. Therefore, there can be no individuality in unity. Because unity cannot limit anything. The moment, however, you place a line between one dot and another, that line becomes an imaginary radius of a circle, and the interval becomes the radius of the circle of individuality. This is developed along the concept which Pythagoreans held, that the moment you establish the consciousness of identity or unity, you destroy the illusion of interval. Therefore, the achievement of total unity destroys the interval between self and eternity. For the universal is equidistant from that which is only one dot. But it is divided into a hypothetical interval plus another interval, where another dot is introduced. For example, if you have two dots and infinity, you have two intervals. The interval between the two dots, measurable, and the interval between one dot and eternity, immeasurable. Therefore, you have what is called measurable and immeasurable intervals. Measurable interval carries with it the entire intellectual life of the individual. And if you assume that these two dots are then connected by a thread, that thread is the single cord of the monochord. And wherever two dots are established, the thread can be extended between them. The interval can be considered an octave and broken up into a group of harmonic and inharmonic intervals. So that the interval between the dots, regardless of its hypothetical length or shortness, becomes a total tone susceptible of division into a complete range of total qualities. This, in turn, produces from itself what the Pythagoreans considered to be the concept of the solar system and the universe. For the universe consists primarily of that which bridges primary intervals, which is the establishment of the two dots. Now, these two dots are subservient to and inferior to units, because they are halves of the principle of unity. But between these halves of unity, or divided parts, is an interval which can be mathematically cut, either by what is called equal or the unequal cut. And by this equal or unequal process of cutting, an entire group of psychic potentials are released along this thread or cord which unites two bodies in intervals. Now, we also have another use of the type of the concept of interval in music. We have interval in terms of pause or a break of tone. We have interval in terms of the spacing in rhythm and in practically all musical motion. So motion is rhythmic as it extends through intervals. And the various possibilities of these rhythmic motions through intervals become the basis of the various types of motion which can exist in space. Now, Pythagoras conceived of this primary interval as being broken into a series of unequal parts, which are called numbers. And these numbers, extending from 1 to 10, are represented by frets, which give upon this string 10 possible tonal lengths. These tones, in turn, through their various vibratory lengths, produce by vibration another motion, because we have at this time considered only motion in terms of interval between two dots. The vibration of a string produces another kind of motion. This is the motion that you get, for instance, in an electrocardiogram. Because in an electrocardiograph, you have not only a motion on a level or on a line, but you have an eccentric motion, which we would say on the cardiograph is up and down. In other words, the motion is not a direct motion, but maybe a broken motion, a jagged motion, an angular motion, consisting of curves or angles, ascending and descending from the line. If we could see, under very powerful magnification, a string which is sounding, we would observe that this string is moving back and forth on its own axis, that there is an ascending and descending arc on each side of the string in motion. Therefore, we develop in the concept of motion not only a motion from one place to another, but an up and down motion, or a motion crossing the original line of motion. This, according to the Pythagorean system, was very, very important. For just as the individual learning to write may first draw a line, then make upper and lower lines from this, an irregular motion. So in the terms of the Pythagorean theory, this quality of motion not only occurs upon a line, but within the scope of a solid. Inasmuch as hypothetical, a story could be constructed upon a line in motion, and the vibration of the line would strike all surfaces of the solid. In other words, if you place a hollow cube with the ends removed around a moving string, if this string was vibrated sufficiently, or the cube was small enough, the string would strike all the surfaces of the cube while in motion. I hope that point is clear. I'm trying to make it. But in other words, your string is moving in a variety of directions in the process of vibration. The motion is very slight, but nevertheless, it is true and real, whether we can see it or grasp its import or not. Those of you who saw Fantasia, the motion picture, will remember that Tchaikovsky, in one part of the picture, created some diagrammatic representations in light and color of the motion of strings in a musical instrument. This is the type of thing which we are trying to call to your attention. Namely, that this vibration requires not only surface motion, but requires motion with depth and dimension. And therefore, that motion inevitably lead from surface to solid, and that all motion gradually develops polarity and becomes a solid field. Moving things become solid fields while they are in motion. This is an important point because in modern research, the motion of space and the motion of the continuum is causing us to contemplate that in the solid intervals of this vibratory motion, there may be other complete orders of life besides the ones that we know. In other words, in the dimension of motion alone, there is a possibility that this same space that we occupy be occupied with a multitude of other creational systems, which we cannot see and cannot realize and cannot know exist because they exist in the interval between the vibratory rates that we know or that we have come to recognize. In the interval problem, then, we have in the tetraxis of Pythagoras each dot surrounded by total intervals. The distance between all dots is the same, except upon the circumference of the figure. For the outer rows of dots have intervals to those below or above them, except for the top, which has only intervals downward, and the bottom, which has only intervals upward. But the figures themselves are surrounded by equal intervals, and the entire figure is suspended in interval itself. In other words, in total interval. It would be quite natural and reasonable, then, to conceive these figures as representing the entire theory of what we call today vibration, with which the ancients had already made calculations, but about which they did not have quite the concept of exactitude modern science has made possible. But they were working upon this principle very definitely. Now, considering the tetraxis as monads, or as units of life, and following the concept of Leibniz and its monadology, we know that all forms are aggregates of monads, of which the tetraxis is the ideal archetype of organized form. Therefore, we say that these monads, in themselves and of themselves, could be floating like specks of inconceivably minute dust forever in space, without organization or arrangement. We may assume, with some of the early thinkers, that these monads radiated sufficient energy to make impossible the striking of one against another. Even this, however, is a doubtful hypothesis. The second is that these monads could accidentally meet and merge and mingle, thus creating compounds. The Pythagoreans held a rather different attitude on this, however, because they used the principle of intervals to cover the entire concept of the field of monadal activity in space. Assuming that monads of themselves could not be superior to themselves, and that these various monadal units were relatively equal, though perhaps diverse in quality, but that they were not susceptible of domination over each other, and each had only a separate and complete subsistence in its own nature, and each was a unit of eternal energy in its own right. Then came the problem as to how these primordial monads were brought together in the organization of the universe. Leibniz suggested that there was a concatenation of monadal archetypes. In other words, that monads were parts of larger monads. These, in turn, of still larger ones, and that there was thus an orderly progression of monads, with infinite diversity at its lower extremity, and unity as the supreme all-enclosing monad at its apex. In this thinking, of course, Leibniz was very, very much a Pythagorean, because he conceived of the single monad as being the all-inclusive archetype, and followed Pythagoras in the concept that distance and development and growth exist within archetypes. Now we think of archetypes as patterns, and many persons, even following the Platonic concept of archetypes, feel that these forms or images held in the divine mind are, as it were, sketched or drawn upon the surface of consciousness, that all things more or less receive these impressions into their structure and are therefore copied from ideal patterns. However, both Pythagoras and Leibniz were of the opinion that the archetype is the all-inclusive monad of anything. Therefore, that all things that bear a certain archetype exist always within that archetype, and that archetype occupies a place, and that place is the total sum of its own parts. Thus, all forms of life that have an existence under pattern are within the pattern. They are not merely copying it. They are not merely following it. It is not merely projected upon them. They are totally and continuously and eternally within it. Because all parts are but miniatures of the totalities of which they are parts. Therefore, they can never be separate from their own totality, except on the level of phenomena. And the noumenal level, they cannot be separated. Thus, the archetypal pattern of Pythagoras implies that the whole universe, everything that exists, exists within a monadal archetype, which is the tetrad, or the great sequence of the numbers, surrounded, as it were, by this flaming symbol of the upright triangle. A universe unfolding within the boundaries of consciousness, intelligence, and force, which are the lines of the triangle, or the three sides of the delta. This is the same Delta, of course, that was said to have been hidden by the patriarch Melchizedek in the depths of the royal arches, and was later found and restored by Enoch and Methuselah. Now in the Tetractus, we have also a number of numbers that we must think about. On the first row, we have the monad alone. This tells us that one is superior to all. I've told you before that Pythagoras did not regard the one or the two as numbers. But the one and the two are placed in the archetypal form. For the archetypal unit, the universe itself, has as its archetypal pattern or rule diversity within unity. Two is the archetype of diversity, but it's subservient to and inferior to the archetype of unity. Therefore, the principle of diversity has passed the power of the principle of unity, because it is a divided power. And in Pythagorean division, that which is divided loses according to the ratio of division. Therefore, division or diversity can never be equal in strength to unity. If it was equal or could be superior, it could destroy unity. But it can never destroy, because in a state of division, things can never have the strength of unity. And in order to achieve that strength of unity, they must annihilate their own diversity. And the moment they do so, they are unity. Therefore, the concept of the rebellion and the rebellious angels in the Pythagorean system, evil can never triumph over good. Because no matter how strong it can be, evil can never be more than one half the strength of good, because it arises from diversity. And is a result of never being equal to good. It can only equal unity by reconciling its own division. And if it reconciles its own division, it is no longer division, it is unity, an evil creature. Evil, therefore, is division. And if the division is destroyed or removed, then unity alone remains. And this brings us to a very interesting phase of Pythagorean thought, which is the similitude and dissimilitude of number. All numbers in any level have a similitude to similar numbers in all other structures in the universe. Therefore, numerically, there is a similitude in the numerative soul between 11 elephants and 11 mice. The similitude lies in the number 11, which is a totality and a concept. This does not mean that they are identical, but 11 of anything will have the principle of 11 in common. Always, therefore, things are of their own similitude. All unities, therefore, on any level, have a similitude to reality, to deity itself. All divisions on any level have a similitude to division in principle. And it is the rule of division that it can never have the same power that unity has. Diversity can never, therefore, overwhelm or overcome the principle of unity. One of the examples of that is that diversity is separated by the primary interval, which we said is intellect. That is the reason why you can have 500 different denominations of one religion. And while these denominations are measured by the interval of intellect, they will never get together. they cannot unite while the interval remains. For this reason, Pythagoras said that two wrongs can never unite and become one wrong. Because the moment they united, they would be good. They would be God again. Therefore, two rascals can never have the same fraternity that two good people can have. It is impossible for diversity ever to win. It is impossible for corruption ever to win. For diversity, by principle, cannot unite with itself. Therefore, the thieves cannot get along together. And they found out in Cicero a number of years ago that if you just left the racketeers alone long enough, they'd kill each other and save the government considerable expense. Of course, they might get a few honest citizens in the interval, but ultimately, people who have those characteristics will outwit each other, will prey upon each other, will injure each other, and ultimately destroy each other. Therefore, no amount of wrong pieced together can ever become a unity. Therefore, it can never be a dynamic. It must always be a static. No matter how much wrong there is in the universe, it can never in substance equal one good. On the other hand, good, one, symbolizing truth, reality, wisdom, is compatible with unity everywhere. Two truths uniting become one truth. Two errors can never unite. Therefore, regardless of everything that happens, growth is the inevitable union of realities and the impossibility of the union of unreality. Therefore, we may see what appears to be advantageous coalescences of despots. We may see dictators creating treaties, but these are not treaties of union, they are treaties of expedience. And if either of these men gets to a condition where he does not need the other, he will break the treaty. There is no integrity. Wisdom also is forever building, and all that men learn that is true becomes part of one ever-increasing truth. We may make mistakes, we may have to do it over again. Sometimes we thought it was true and it wasn't. But if it is not true, it will fall away. It cannot survive. But whereas truths are always coalescing, so that the good man of any faith will ultimately be one with the good man of any other faith, because by their conduct, by their principles, by their codes, they have in common even what their words may deny. Realities build forever. Because realities are unities which unite to form unities. Because each reality is a unity. But each unit of error is itself a diversity or a duality. So all realities become or are by nature one. All error is by nature two. And it is interesting that Pythagoras, in his thinking, should assign the word science to the number two. Because he pointed out that science requires for its existence two dots and an interval. And without this, it is immeasurable and unknowable. Because science cannot function without comparison, without weighing things against each other, by a period or process of criticism, by the estimation of the action of phenomena upon phenomena, it can never arrive at a conclusion from a single monad. It must always use comparative power for the determination of its findings. Therefore, it can extend itself over an area and can make the interval between the two monads as great as it may conceive. But in order to exist as a science, the scientist must have two objects, at least, upon which to function. He must say, this is small because this is larger. He cannot determine the nature of size because he has only relativity. And the concept of estimation based upon two dots in an interval is properly termed relativity, because it depends for all conclusion and deduction upon the weighing or estimating of one thing by another. Whereas Pythagoras said, unity is the estimation of things by itself. Thus, unity represents intuitive or apperceptive comprehension of the unity of things, whereas all phenomenal knowledge depends upon duality. You can take an interval of two dots, and you can place science on one end, philosophy on the other. Or you can take religion and science. Or you can come down to another level, and you can say management and labor. You can come down to any level you want. You can then take all the articles or artifacts that are used in the maintenance of modern culture, government and the governed, credit, debt. You can go through every phase of a material culture, and it subsists only because of two units and an interval. And therefore, it belongs essentially to the sphere of diversity or duality. And because of that, these various activities can of themselves never coalesce. They can never unify, because they belong to a principle of diversity. And the only way in which they can be reconciled is by means of the numerative soul power in man, who alone can bind these things together. And to bind these things together, he must have the apperceptional power of the monad, which theoretically the Greeks would have called in the intelligible power of nature. In other words, the individual, to reconcile opposites of any kind, must obtain a position of unity superior to the opposite which he wishes to reconcile. He must therefore, in qualitative intervals, ascend above the duality. His own consciousness must be higher than division, or he can never reconcile divided parts. In every part of nature, therefore, in the moral life of man, the solution of a problem, and a problem is two dots in an interval, regardless of what the problem may be, because it is a problem perhaps of decision. Decision is two possible causes and their consequences, the interval. The only possible way of solving a problem of diversity is by attaining an apex of unity above it. This means that we can never solve a problem of living on a level. Therefore, we can never solve a problem mathematically. The solution to problems is geometric, because we have to move into other dimensions. As long as we are mathematical, we are functioning on the level of the motion of numbers. And the motion of number is from one to diversity. The only way in which we can transcend or unify diversity is through ascending up the geometric ladder from the solid to the surface to the line to the point. He makes a very great deal of this. Of course, his thinking on it is much more complete than we have been able even to speculate to Jesus. All we can do is take a few symbolical points out of it. Because it was said years, it took his own disciples 30 and 40 years to get the first principle. So we're not going to make it this evening. But we can suggest certain lines of speculation. Now in Plato, we have the same thinking in a little more simple, familiar term. In the contrast between Plato and Aristotle. We have, for instance, Aristotle, who would walk into the city and try to understand it by counting the streets and the houses. And he would gradually come to a conclusion, and he would finally make you a drawing of the city. And the drawing of the city would be comparatively accurate. But it is very possible, as the old saying goes, which is, we most of you know, that he would never see the city for the houses. He would become constantly more and more immersed in the details of the city. And probably somewhere along the line, he would find something so devastatingly interesting in the city that he would stay there for the rest of his life. Plato, on the other hand, assumed that the proper course for man is to first climb up the mountain and look down on the city. And having first seen the city as a totality, then to descend into the city, bearing always in his mind the total picture, then explore the street and become immersed in the details. He could then do it safely because he had already a vision of the city, which he could not lose. And therefore, the city from that time on had a meaningful topography for him, far greater than it could possibly have been had he begun to examine first. So that in this sense of the word, the man who climbs up onto the mountain takes the position of the one dot at the top of the pyramid. He stands there and looks in all directions, including downward. He sees the entire pattern of the unfoldment of the order of both numeration and number. He may then go downward into the city, and he may take science, or he may take art, or he may take music. And he may become greatly involved in these little dots and the intervals between them. But he still has within his consciousness the recognition of the archetype of totality. He has seen the whole picture. He has seen the city. Therefore, he is not going to lose sight of the city and become hopelessly bogged down in some detail. Now, he may assume, Aristotle probably did assume, that no individual could master the all of this tremendous picture. Therefore, he could spend his life studying one of the intervals between two dots, and that would be the most he could hope to accomplish. Here, however, Pythagoras would have corrected him on this point, that regardless of whether he knows it or not, he will never be able to understand the interval between two dots until he understands the whole picture. Therefore, his study of any particular thing inevitably depends for its accuracy, for its fertility, for its reality, upon the total context. Therefore, the study of diversity without an apperception of unity will lead to materialism. Because this means the exaggeration of the significance of parts above that of totality. The individual who spends all his life picking up Abyssinian or Babylonian Rome is quite certain that history began and ended in Babylonia. And that the most valuable of all possible activities is turning the soil and finding these little cylinders with the name of some very ancient king cast and carved into the surface. When he finds one of them, he is happier than the Texas oil magnate who has discovered 10 new oil wells. This little cylinder becomes his life. Now he becomes what might be termed an authority on the subject. But being an authority on it, he is still completely uninformed on the essential reasons not only for life, but for those little roles that he himself is handling. He will never understand the Assyrians, or the Chaldeans, or the Arcadians, and took to understand their relation to the various intervals which make up the complete field and are enclosed within totality. We will never realize the lesson of a civilization until he is aware of the grand motion of civilization. He will never have any true elevation of himself as being. He will never gain the experience of unity in these things, which is necessary to make them meaningful, if he remains hopelessly immersed in the diversity. Therefore, the number two not only becomes the sum of number of signs, but it becomes the number of specializations. It becomes the number of all involved by which man enters into a competitive relationship with himself, with others, or with knowledge. And the understanding of this as the correction of the interval through the reestablishment of the total concept of unity is the rescuing of the monadal power of the archetype. Or it is what is called, or we call, the numerative soul, or the soul which orders things and reduces all numbers to their part in unity. A very large and important concept. And it takes much more time sometimes to talk about these things, and it's much less profitable than the experiences which the individual himself has. And each person, whether he knows it or not, frequently establishes unity without knowing that he is doing so, because he is instinctively following the habit of the numerative soul within himself. So Pythagoras pointed out one other point that is very valuable, namely, that unity is something which is natural to things. Diversity is something that is artificial to unity represents the eternal state of the divine nature. God, in order to create, had to perform a separate and distinct action. Therefore, this action was artificial to the nature of deity itself. And in man, in his contemplation of existence, is naturally good, but must create evil. Everywhere in the universe, unity is a natural thing unless it is artificially prevented from existing or manifesting. Men must therefore dynamically misunderstand in order to have difficulty. And so-called misunderstanding is simply a lack of understanding, and lack of understanding is lack of unity, or lack of the unity's power in consciousness. Therefore, diversity is an artificial condition, which is not permanent, nor real, but only apparent, whereas unity is a natural and eternal condition, real, though not apparent. But through the philosophical study of number, the reality of unity can be mathematically demonstrated, and the unreality of diversity can be mathematically demonstrated. And in this way, appeal to certain minds so constituted that they are naturally inclined to accept upon this level. Now there's more to be said, and less than a few.